Good morning, 741 here on the Mighty 690. And it is time for our chat with folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And joining us, we have horticulture agent Jesse Gilmore. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Answering a lot of questions about tomatoes right now.
I bet you are. And well, one thing I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but with this high heat that we have, do we kind of have to have a, this is my question, I'm getting it done right off the bat, do we have to have a period of like over 100 to where they stop setting flowers?
So that actually is one of the most common questions I get when it comes to tomatoes, but I haven't gotten that question yet this year.
Because it hasn't really happened yet.
Right. It's been unusually mild for early summer compared to what we had last year especially. But tomatoes have problems setting fruit when the temperature stays over a certain amount. And we're not exactly sure what that temperature is, but the problem is that high heat denatures the grains of pollen that pollinate flowers. And so when you get pollen traveling from one flower to another, if that pollen grain is denatured, it is not going to pollinate the flower, and you're not going to get fruit set, even though the pollen has basically done 90% of the work getting from one flower to another. And there's not really anything that gardeners can do about the heat denaturing the pollen. Really, the only thing you can do at that point is if you're having trouble with fruit set, which, based on the tomato plants I've seen so far, I've seen lots of fruit on these plants. So it seems like we're getting pretty good fruit set so far. But if you do have problems with that in the future, your only bet is to manually pollinate. So take something like a small paintbrush and rub it on one of the flowers and then carry it over to another flower. And the idea behind that is you're just increasing the probability that at least one of those grains of pollen is viable and that it will get to the other flower to pollinate it. So you're basically just increasing the odds that something is going to stick. It's like the shotgun approach.
Right.
So I don't expect to see much of that because by now most people have their fruit on the tomato plant and the tomatoes are growing pretty well. But that is something to keep in mind in the future, because I am expecting heat a little bit later in the growing season.
Yeah. So what questions have you been having and other things that people should know right now regarding tomatoes?
Yeah. So two diseases, one environmental reaction. I won't necessarily call it a problem because it's actually the tomato plant's reaction to the heat and trying to conserve water in the plant tissue. So primarily what I have gotten recently is questions about tomato plants that look like they're wilting. The leaves are folding upward, kind of like a book, almost perfectly in half. And this is happening over the entire plant. This is actually just an extreme case of what's known as physiological leaf roll. It is the plant's effort to minimize the surface area of leaf tissue so that it catches less sunlight and less water evaporates out of it. You see this a lot with really high temperatures. We're seeing it a little earlier in the year than what we're used to, and we're also seeing it on the entire plant, which is not typical of physiological leaf roll, but it's also not unheard of. When you have physiological leaf roll, most of the time you will only see it occur in the upper parts of the plant, the newest leaves that are farthest away from the water source, which is the roots. I think just based on our weather, it's been a very weird year for plants so far, and that is carrying over to the annuals, not just the woody plants that I've been answering questions about. But the upward cupping, not cupping, the upward folding almost of the leaves is a pretty good indication that you are dealing with physiological leaf roll. If you're seeing something like herbicide injury, herbicide drift, tomatoes are very sensitive to herbicide drift. They're usually one of the first plants to show signs. of herbicide injury. The cupping is going to be more along the edges of the leaf than the entire leaf folding upward. You would also more expect to see downward cupping and folding if it was herbicide injury. So if it is physiological leaf roll, and you can always send photos in to our office or my email address to get a diagnosis. That is not injurious to the plant at all. You can expect the plant to snap out of it. And you don't really want to water more frequently at that point. You want to keep your watering relatively the same because people have a tendency to overcorrect when it comes to watering. And they see a plant wilting or what they think is wilting, and they just pour water on it every day. Every day, the roots can't dry out. And that can cause root rot issues if you keep the root system watered or overwatered. So it is always a good idea to let the soil dry out at least the top inch before watering again. The top inch is on your pointer finger from the tip of the finger to your first knuckle. So if you don't feel any moisture in the soil at that point when you're sticking that in the soil, it is a good time to rewater. And you're going to see the most benefit to watering in the morning, right as the plant is becoming active, but before it becomes really hot. I would also definitely recommend mulching. Mulching will keep water in the soil for longer, so that the plant has more moisture it can access. It will keep the sun off of the soil so that evaporation losses are less. It keeps weeds from growing. There's a lot of benefits to mulching, and I could do honestly an entire talk on mulching. But those are the primary benefits to keeping water in the soil, which is becoming an increasing concern. Not necessarily because it is as hot as it was last year, but because our spring was much drier than we're used to. We are still at about half, and it kind of depends on our listening area where you're listening in from. But a lot of places in southeast Kansas are at about half of their average rainfall for the last 365 days. So that is an extreme departure from what we are used to. Hopefully, it is only a temporary departure. I know Independence has gotten quite a bit of rain over the last 2 or 3 weeks. So hopefully, they spread that out a little more to the rest of the area. But that is the primary question I have been answering when it comes to tomatoes. Now, I have been getting other questions related to disease. People are starting to see their tomato leaves crisp up. So brown necrotic lesions all over their tomato plants. Sometimes it's affecting their entire tomato plants. They've still got the fruit. The fruit is still looking good, but the leaf area has just crumbled to dust, basically. That is a disease called early blight. It is fungal, like 90% of all plant diseases that you can, or that plants can get. And so it is made worse, and the infection happened because of an extended period of wet and humid conditions. Fungal spores of all kinds are present all over plants that you put in the garden, but they can't infect plants. Most of them won't infect plants. Most of them are not going to be disease-causing. But the ones that are can't infect the tissue that they are on until they are exposed to a certain amount of water and a certain length of time where they remain wet. So there are a couple of things that you can do to control diseases like early blight. Another one that I have gotten, I think, one question on that affects tomatoes around the same time as early blight is known as septoria leaf spot. They are often partner diseases in that they show up at exactly the same time, have pretty much the same causes. I believe the fungal spores that cause each of those diseases are in the same genus, so they're very closely related. I might be wrong on that though, but the control is going to be pretty much the same between both of them. It's likely that the disease, not germinated, infected the plants about 3 weeks to a month ago. That's pretty much the incubation time that you can expect for the symptoms to start showing. So if you have problems with these two diseases in particular. They are typically going to show up only on tomatoes, but they can transfer over to other solanaceous crops, so peppers, eggplant, potatoes. There are cultural control methods that you can use, but if you did want to use a chemical, copper fungicides are going to have the best results for the least cost, and you would need to spray them around the end of May or beginning of June to make sure that you kill off the pathogens, especially if you get heavy rains during the growing season. Because fungal pathogens are they require water in order to spread, in order to infect. Long periods of really high intensity sunlight doesn't necessarily need to be heat, but heat will also kill off the spores. You can expect that to do a lot of sanitation for you.
Okay.
So spraying is not always necessary, but we deal with early blight enough. Septoria leaf spot, not as much, but early blight I see enough of to where I might recommend some preventative spraying on tomatoes. As far as cultural control methods, so methods or changes to your management strategies of tomatoes in order to reduce disease pressure. When you're watering the plant, you want to make sure that you are not watering so that the spray from your hose, for example, ends up on the branches. You want to keep the water as low to the ground as possible, and that just prevents water from sitting on the leaves for too long. You want to make sure when you are plant or transplanting your tomatoes that you are caging your tomatoes, that they stay upright so that the foliage is not folding in on itself. You also might, and this is a little more up to you also might decide to selectively prune off specific branches on the plant in order to allow for more airflow through the canopy. So wind is going to be your best friend when it comes to making sure that disease pressures stay at a minimum, because the more wind you get through the canopy of the plant, and I say canopy like it's a tree, but
Sure.
any leaf area is considered a canopy, whether it's on an herbaceous plant or a woody plant. The more wind you can get through that canopy, the less disease pressure you're going to have because your leaves are going to dry off more quickly after rainfall. So that's a good way to just some easy steps to take to minimize disease pressure. Other steps, if you are experiencing a lot of disease pressure in your garden, and people don't want to hear this because they love planting tomatoes. Tomatoes are the number one garden vegetable grown in the country. Rotate to a different crop, or at the very least, move your tomatoes from one spot in the garden to another spot. It is usually good practice to transition families of crops from one spot in the garden to another so that you are not always putting the crop in the same spot and allowing disease pressures to build up in that one specific geographic area of the garden. So things like solanaceous crops, allium crops, leaf vegetables don't really fall into one specific family. They're more general, but basically moving them throughout the garden. And that also helps if you are experiencing bug pressure, especially not planting a specific crop for a year or two, doesn't provide those bugs the food that they need. Some bugs are host specific, like squash bug. So not planting squash for a year or two will absolutely decimate the population because they won't have enough food to support all of the eggs that they laid.
Okay.
Tomatoes don't really, well, outside of the tomato hornworm, tomatoes don't really suffer from any host-specific insects. The insects that are going to be feeding on tomatoes are more general. So you would need to control the insect populations that you are seeing, like aphids, army worms are feeding on tomatoes this year, and they do from time to time when the populations are particularly bad. You would need to control that with some kind of spray instead of cultural controls like rotation, because you're not able to rotate outside of controlling tomato hornworm, which I've heard quite a few of this year. Swapping to another plant won't work on those pests because they will just go to the other plant and start eating that. So if you are experiencing insect pressures, neem oil is what I recommend. It's a common organic insecticide. It's derived from a tree in India. And it sounds totally, what's the word? Kind of like homeopathic
Oh,
medicine,
sure.
like, home remedy type
Yeah.
stuff. But no, a lot of plants develop botanical defense mechanisms to keep bugs from feeding on it. That's why coffee has caffeine in it, because caffeine is actually an insecticide when bugs are chewing on it, because they ingest so much of the caffeine relative to their body size that they die from caffeine
Oh, that's
overdoses.
fascinating.
And so we get the benefit of the caffeine in coffee, and coffee is, I believe, the second most traded commodity in the world. Yeah, no, plants derive these amazing mechanisms of controlling insect damage on them in order to prolong their own life and make sure that they reproduce. So, neem oil is derived from a tree that went through that similar development of an insecticide in order to keep bugs from feeding on it. And so, neem oil is just a spray. You spray it on your plants, and it affects the biological systems of insects that people don't have. So, it is essentially, not completely, obviously, I don't want to make that claim, but it is very low toxicity to people and mammals compared to insects.
Hey, well, that is good. So, Jesse, as we're running out of time here, if people do have questions about tomatoes or any garden vegetables, of course, what's the best way to get a hold of you if they do have those questions?
They can call any of our offices. My phone number for the Girard office is 620-724-8233. Or if they need to get in touch with their state's extension office or their county's extension office, Oklahoma State, University of Missouri, and University of Arkansas. If they want to email me, my email address is jr637@ksu.edu.
Okay, well, thank you, Jesse. Appreciate it. And always good to chat. And it's exciting when we've got garden vegetables growing. I mean, man, the difference is it's just so amazing.
Yeah, it
So,
feels pretty empowering.
yeah, it really is fun. So, coming up, we do have Wendy Powell will be coming on to talk some. What are you talking about? Hay prices. Okay, it's on the way here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Good morning, 8:11 here on the Mighty 690, and it is time to continue our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension, and we have Livestock Agent Wendy Powell in studio. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great. How about you?
Hey, good to have you here. So, we are continuing to go through the end of June, and we're going to talk about a near and dear topic to a lot of people. And I saw some of the folks over east of town cutting some hay. And,
yes.
And it's that time of year.
It is indeed. I get lots of phone calls this time of year from folks that are producing hay wanting to sell it. You know, how do they price their hay? And then occasionally I get calls in the wintertime from buyers of hay asking what reasonable prices are. They're looking for hay and they want to pay a reasonable price for it. So just to dig in, it's a wild west rodeo out there, hay pricing. There are so many variables. There's no, like futures markets, things like that with wheat and corn. You know, we see those prices. We have radio reports of what those prices are, but hay production is a whole different ball game. It's completely different. The only thing that we have to go off of is the information from production and then from history of like a personal history of how much you've paid in the past, things like that. So it's just crazy how varied this can be.
No, I mean that is interesting. You know, it's just not really standardized like so much of agriculture in general is. So,
mm-hmm.
Of course, I guess there's probably lots of different factors that go into trying to determine some of this cost.
Sure. Yeah, from the producer's standpoint, determining your cost of production is one easy way to set your bale price. However, whenever you actually consider your cost of production, it's a lot of math. What does it cost to actually harvest that grass, roll it up in a bale? So that's going to be fertilizer, weed control, anything like that. But then you also have to look at all of your fixed costs that are not associated exactly with that enterprise. So land taxes, insurance. You know, if you're using the same tractor to bale hay that you do to other enterprises on your operation, all of that plays a role in the cost of production.
Sure. So yeah, your baler, if you borrow one or if you have one.
Exactly.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. And then, you know, a large custom hay harvester, they're, you know, just because of economy of scale, it's cheaper for them to produce one bale because they can use the equipment so many more times versus a smaller operation where they have a baler and all the equipment for a fewer acres. Goodness. So determining that cost of production is the best way to set your price of hay. Add in your profit margin there. If it is your livelihood, then you obviously have to take care of your living expenses. So you add in your profit margin there, and that's your cost of hay.
Gotcha. So what about, you know, does the type of hay matter, or, you know, is this just grass? I mean, you know, is it just grass? You know?
Right. So when you just look out your window driving down the highway at 65 miles an hour, it does kind of all look the same for a while.
Yeah.
But then when you actually walk through it, there are very, very few monocultures in hay fields. So monocultures being like, it's only Bermuda grass or it's only alfalfa, things like that. So lots of times it's mixed grass, but for those that are producing hay in large quantities, sometimes they will try to make those monocultures. And whenever we talk about that, we can get down into the weeds about quality, protein, energy. All of these grass species have different qualities. So obviously our alfalfa, that's kind of our top of the line stuff. That's used a lot in horse operations, in dairies. It's a supplement in our beef cattle operations and in other livestock operations. But whenever we talk about just prairie hay, that is used a lot of times around here for cow-calf operations as filler. Sometimes we'll have to add a lot more to that to make it a full ration for an animal. But then we also have to look at the potential toxins. So last year was a drought. We had lots of issues with nitrates in corn stalks, sedan grass, sorghum sedan, hay grazer, all of those products. We have nitrate issues, which is what the plant does to protect itself. But that's harmful to animals. And then whenever we look at alfalfa, you have to worry about blister beetle if you're feeding that to horses. So you always want to go for the second cutting in alfalfa. So there's, just because it's hay does not necessarily mean it's safe for every class of animal.
Sure. Sure, there's a lot that goes into all of this. It's just amazing. Now, what about, you know, hay quality? How do we actually determine something like that?
Yeah, so a lot of times folks just want to eyeball things. That's the easiest and the cheapest way to do it. So we're looking at the leaf-to-stem ratio. Whenever you have a broadleaf hay like alfalfa, then you want a lot of those leaves to remain in the bale and on the stem because that's what animals really get a lot of nutrients out of, and it's more palatable. Whereas the stem, like a bale of corn stalks, say, that's a lot more unpalatable. Animals will eat it if they're hungry, but it's not as nutritious either. So our leaf-to-stem ratio is one thing to look at. But then I always encourage folks just to have it lab tested. It's inexpensive to have samples pulled and send it to a lab. It's you can get your protein, your energy, your dry matter information, and then also you can test for any nitrates or other toxicities if you're worried about those. So usually we're talking $20 or less to have these tested. And I tell you what, cattle are a whole lot more expensive than that. So,
and is that something that K-State Extension can help you with?
Yes, absolutely. We have forage probes at all of our offices, and folks can check those out to pull samples, and I'd be happy to walk them through those processes.
Good deal. So as far as information on current pricing. How do we find this out?
Yeah, so kind of like with pasture rent, a lot of times we want to keep that a secret, how mm-hmm. much we're paying for hay or how much we're charging for hay, just because you don't want somebody else to take your good deal. But whenever we're honest and open about things, everybody does better. So talk to your neighbors if that's a conversation that you guys can have. The best unbiased resource we have right now is our Kansas Hay Report. Our USDA Ag Marketing Service actually puts a hay report out for many states. So we can go on their website every Tuesday. The Kansas Hay Report is updated and we can pull those prices, and everything is priced by class. So like you'll have your alfalfa and your brome and your native grass, all of it separately. And then it's even broke out from large square bales, large round bales, small squares, all these things.
Okay.
So
no, that's nice.
All of that factors into the price.
And I was going to ask you, since you brought it up, the last time I remember seeing square bales is like north central Kansas, you know? Is there much of an advantage to that as far as, you know, from a producer standpoint? I mean, here around here, it's just big round bales is a lot of what you see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so big round bales are like that economy of scale. It's just easier to handle, literally, to take a large round bale from the hay field and put it in a hay pen for storage and then take that out to feed your cows in the wintertime or whatever livestock you've got. Square bales certainly have a place, like with show animals.
Yeah, horse people like them, of course.
Yes, yep. It's easier to hand feed from square bales. But yeah, a lot of folks around here have gone to the large rounds. There are a few square bales. You'll see straw put up in the square bales oftentimes because that's used for bedding a lot. But yeah, I would say up north, they definitely have more square bales, but we do have some around here, and that's the use of that is the hand feeding more than the bulk feeding larger groups of animals.
Gotcha. So going back to production costs, what are some other things that we want to be aware of?
Yeah, so I mentioned these, the cost, the fixed cost, labor, land taxes, equipment, all of those things factor in. Then we also have to look at the actual growing of the grass. So planting that grass, if it's an annual, we have to worry about weed control because we don't want something coming in there that's going to present problems. And then also we look at if you are planting, let's say you've got teff or sedan grass this summer, but you could have put that hay field into soybeans or something else. So what was that opportunity cost? Also transportation, and this could be fuel, you know, from the headquarters of your farm out to the hay field and getting that hay, going around the hay field so many times, all that fuel cost, but also the transportation of moving that hay from the field to its final storage space or to the buyer's location. All of those costs factor in. And a lot of times folks won't really consider the depreciation, land taxes, anything like that in their hay baling cost, just because it can be arbitrary how much to assign to each enterprise. But for those that are doing hay production as a living, you have to include that in your operation costs. Otherwise, your operation's not going to be sustainable.
Sure. No, that's a good point. Now, once the hay is in a bale, is that price going to change?
It could very easily. Last year, you know, we suffered from a drought. This year, we are seeing lower quantities of hay coming off of hay fields just because everything got set back because of the lack of moisture. So hay availability certainly does make the price change. You know, if you're holding on to some hay that's pretty good quality and you have it stored properly where it's not getting a lot of moisture on it, then that hay could increase in price just due to lack of supply later on this winter. So yeah, hay prices can change even after it's been baled. Storage conditions plays a big factor in quality, because if it's stored outside, especially I've seen big round bales lately stacked or put in rows where the round sides are touching instead of the flat ends. So those rounded the crevices between those two bales are going to catch moisture, especially
yep,
like
I saw it yesterday.
Yep. You know, when it snows, that snow's just going to sit there until it melts, and that melted snow is just going to go right into the bale, and it's going to really deteriorate the quality so fast. So whenever you're stacking hay, be sure to put the flat ends together and let the dynamic of the bale do its job of protecting from moisture, because
it's like a loaf of bread having the, you know, having the heel on there, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
Keep it going there.
So just like with bread, you know, whenever you have the flat sides together, it protects the next slice over, just because moisture and critters can't necessarily get in there as easily. So definitely, whenever you're storing hay, consider how you're going to use it, how long it's going to sit there. And I realize the benefit of putting the hay bales in the rows where the rounded sides are together is so you can just back up with your hay bale hauler, your feed truck or whatever, and just pick that bale up and take off. But if you're just taking off with a lower quality bale of hay, you're just going to have to haul a whole lot more hay.
Yep.
You're going to have to make that trip a lot more times than if you had stored those bales properly. So we can go into a long discussion about storage, but maybe that's for another day.
Sure. Now, do you think that, I mean, some folks are cutting right now. Around here, are we able to get multiple cuttings in the season like this? Probably maybe one more. What's the usual trend around here?
That's a good question. It all depends on the type of hay that you're working with. So with our native grasses that we see in western Montgomery County, western Wilson County, a lot of times we discourage those from being two cuttings. So we can get one cutting off of those and then let that grass grow back. And then if you want to go ahead and graze it after the first frost, you certainly can. Or if you want to leave that biomass on the pasture to burn in the spring, those are your options there. With fescue, Bermuda grass, crabgrass pastures, hay fields, it just depends on how much moisture we get. So last year, I don't know of anybody that got a second cutting. But this year, if we get the rain in a timely manner, if you're able to fertilize properly, that's the key to getting a second cutting. You always want to leave enough leaf in the field attached to the roots that can serve as a window, that can photosynthesize and regrow those new plants. So you don't want to take so much of the leaf that the plant just withers and dies.
Well, Wendy Powell, if people have questions for you on this or any other livestock topic, how can we get a hold of you?
Sure. You can call me at the Altamont office, 620-784-5337.
All righty. Well, Wendy, appreciate you coming on here today, and good luck here in all your endeavors as we're in this, you know, busy season.
Oh, I do want to mention one more thing.
Yes.
August 3rd is our beef and forage
yes.
field day at the Research Center. So put that in your calendar. I realize that we're several weeks out, but it's never too early to put that on your calendar. August 3rd.
August 3rd. Okay.
Yes.
All righty. Well, Wendy, thanks to you so much, and I hope you have a great rest of your day here.
Thank you. You too.
We'll talk again soon. So we have coming up lots to get to, and Open Line on the way, an early bird edition of that here on the Mighty 690 KGGF.